Okay, we'll start right off. We got a lot to cover. Where will I start? Okay, Patrick Gray has withdrawn from the nomination of the FBI, as head of the FBI. That is good news. There's a second team and a third team behind him, so we have to get some letters out now on the next team. Letters are very important, and this is a very important time in American history, and I want people to do their homework. I'm going to give you two letters to write for this week. This is your assignment. Number one, write to your Senate Judiciary in Washington, D.C. about the appointment. Now that Patrick Gray is out, they're going to suggest the appointment of Henry Peterson as the head of the FBI. And Henry Peterson is an ex-Marine, an FBI agent, who has been in the employment of the FBI, the Justice Department, for a long time. In 1952, he joined the department's criminal division, and in 1966, he was named the chief of organized crime. So the years that Mr. Peterman was in there are very important, 1952 to 1966, because anybody who was in the Justice Department at the time that John Kennedy was killed, or Robert Kennedy, or Martin Luther King, or any of these murders that have been taking place, and I'm going in later into about 110 murders that have been taking place in the Midwest now, linked directly to the Watergate, but any of these political assassinations that this man worked in the Justice Department. He was then part of the team that covered up the truth of the assassinations, and he should be not appointed until the Watergate is totally exposed, and we find out he should be the acting director, if at all, like Patrick Gray was the acting director, until we find out about Mr. Kleindienst, who is the head, the attorney general now. There may be perjury in his ITT testimony. Mr. Kleindienst was held up on his appointment pending the ITT investigation, and that was a complete cover-up last year. The point is that we do not want, I do not want, Henry Peterson as head of the FBI. James McCord said last week to the Senate probe that the criminal justice system is on trial. He made the remark that he couldn't take his evidence, which he's going to begin disclosing tomorrow about the Watergate affair, to the FBI, to the grand jury, or the Justice Department. So why would he take it to a man like Mr. Peterman if he doesn't trust the Justice Department? He doesn't say, I'm going to take it to this particular man. He says, I don't trust the department, and the whole system of justice has to be changed. It has to be flushed out. So Henry Peterman will be suggested as the acting head of the FBI, again, by James Eastland, Senator Eastland, who's a very, very close friend of Fred LaRue, one of the Watergate espionage team, the liaison of John Mitchell, to the White House. Fred LaRue was a man not on salary for 3 years at the White House as part of this espionage operation, close friend of Eastland. And Eastland would like to see Mr. Peterman be head of the FBI. I do not like the suggestion of anyone from that department, as I say, being in there now. One of the things that reminds me of the Warren Commission investigation was that during this summer, this person, Henry Peterson, who suggested as head of the FBI, made the statement, the public may never learn the reasons for the Watergate incident or the identity of persons who might have been involved. Well, that's the way Earl Warren presented the Warren Commission, that we may never know in our lifetime who was involved. But look at it this way. If a mother or a housewife out in Carmel can figure out in 3 weeks who was involved in the Watergate and break down the whole chain of command and the way it operates and give very good leads on finding out who did it, the questions, I can't answer all the questions, but I know what questions to ask and what witnesses to call. So figure it out. If I can put in a real list that went to print first week in August, a whole layout of the way the Watergate took place, why couldn't Mr. Peterson and the Justice Department be figuring some of this out and be bringing in a few rests? What's happening now, the exposures are going to take place in Washington, hopefully with James McCord tomorrow when he begins talking, will force the exposure of what's happening in the Justice Department. It isn't that Congress and the Justice Department wants us to know. The idea the public may never learn is he doesn't want us to learn. We can learn if he wants us to know. There was an article this week about Liddy. He refused to answer questions at the grand jury. And he held on with his silence all week. But among other questions asked him was who hired him to be the attorney to the reelection committee, whether he knew the purpose of the project or the motives of the people involved. Louis Tackwood, agent provocateur in Los Angeles, mentioned the motives in 1971, and the names that he had as part of the plan for martial law were Mr. Martin, that's James McCord, and Mr. White, which is Howard Hunt. And they're not looking into the Tackwood allegations yet. They'll be forced to do that soon. But they're not looking into them yet. But in the meantime, you can write. And the Senate Judiciary, the men that you might be interested in writing to, there's Senator Birch Bayh and Ted Kennedy and Sam Ervin and John McClellan and John Tunney. I imagine Ervin's getting a lot of mail with the publicity coming in on these other things. But any one of those five senators, or if you're really conscientious, write to all five and tell them to hold up any appointment of the acting head of the head of the FBI as an acting head until the Watergate thing is completely laid out. Because at one time they were suggesting Sheriff Peter Pitches to be the head of the FBI, and his department in California is tied into the Watergate, into the espionage operations of the federal government. We don't want any of the public officials or law enforcement agencies that plan conspiracies or conceal conspiracies until the conspiracies are flushed out, and then we'll make our appointments. America is really in a state of crisis, and it's better to not make appointments, just have an acting head with a conditional, and let the judiciary know that we went 10 months without Gray being appointed. We can go 10 months now without another head until something comes along to show which way the government is moving, whether they're really going to expose a lot of this. I got a letter this week from Senator Hartke, and he said it was good to be contacted by you, and correspondence like yours helps more fully to know the current views of the people. I put in a very heavy letter about a lot of things coming down at the Watergate, and I send these off constantly. And the men do read the material. They know what's going on, and if you show them you know, then you give them support for anything that they're going to come out and say. So try to get Mr. Peterson not just as acting head if he has to be assigned at all, but preferably the judiciary should wait until the Watergate thing is really exposed. I want call attention to a letter or ask your presence at a hearing up in Sacramento this week. There's going to be a hearing on the question of lobotomies and brain surgery in California. Wherever the public has become sufficiently aroused now, they're stopping the brain surgery and the brain experiments on prisoners. There was a big issue in Detroit, and a case was halted because there was public protest. There was a very important case that was going on in Maryland this last week. A family wanted their son to have brain surgery. He was diagnosed as schizophrenic, and he evidently became a hippie or a dropout, and they wanted his brain altered. And the Civil Liberties Union came in and said, no, you can't do it. And it was a test case in Virginia. There's another one going on in Michigan. And the brain altering was halted. In California, Ronald Reagan suggested a school to study violence at the University of UCLA. In his speech in January, he mentioned this institute. And more information is coming out about the institute and using brain waves, altering the brain and brain surgery. And Mr. Stubbeline, J.M. Stubbeline, said that the ultimate decision of whose brains would be altered would be made up to him. He said there will be some psychosurgery on a selected basis for curative reasons, and that inmates will be told of their rights and so forth, their legal rights. But then he went on to say a system of safeguards will be developed to ensure the rights of inmates. But, he said, sometimes those rights might have to be overridden. We do not want to violate the individual right or give the state repressive, coercive power unless there is an immense or immediate danger. And in that case, we will overgo any safeguards. We will decide, and ultimately, who decides what minds are altered. Well, the Senate Health and Welfare Committee in Sacramento got information regarding this new institute. The committee opposing psychiatric abuse of prisoners got concerned up in the East Bay area. So there's going to be a public hearing. I'm going up to Sacramento. It's going to be next Wednesday. I very seldom leave home I like to work and research, and I don't like to leave home, but I think this is important, to make your presence known at this time, to, you know, give up one day. If you're not working and you live in the Santa Cruz area, Aptos, Carmel, Salinas, go up to Sacramento. I don't have the room number, so go early or find out, call Sacramento, or when you get there, get to the Capitol building early enough, like 1 o'clock, to find out where the Senate Health and Welfare Committee is. The hearing's going to be at 2 o'clock. That's Wednesday, April the 11th. And if you make your presence known, you see, I've done some research on this institute now, and it's connected to the federal funds and the Los Angeles Police Department. Now, that's the police department that Lewis Tagwood has told us about that will be described in the book, The Glass House Tapes. It is government-controlled, it is conspiratorial, it plans conspiracies against minorities. There's going to be a lot of lawsuits funded against the L.A. Police Department. And the assistant chief of police under Ed Davis left the Los Angeles Police Department and is now on the faculty at UCLA as a consultant to the institute. And the federal funding is coming through the California Department of Justice, so it doesn't look like it's federal money. There's $40 million that could be set aside for this. Could be a massive operation. So it's very important that we go up and stop Mr. Stubblefine. He's the director of health planning, and I've been listing recently for an article all of the different medicines and techniques used at Vacaville and the Tuscadero at the present time on prisoners, and it's just terrible. So go up to Sacramento, that's Wednesday, April the 11th at 2 o'clock, or else write the Senate Health and Welfare Committee, the Senate Health and Welfare Committee, Capitol Building, say, I cannot come to Sacramento, but I resent the university lending their name and their so-called respectability to altering the minds of people in this state or any other state. So let yourself be heard. Well, I'm going to get right on to what is going to be or could be one of the biggest stories in the country that is related to the Watergate. Oh, I just want to digress 1 minute. Martha Mitchell said last week in the news when she was relating her Watergate experiences and crying for help, there was an article which I got from Washington where she said they wanted to put me into a mental institution after she was thrown through the glass and beaten up out in California. They wanted to put her in a mental institution. Now, you see, you have Dita Baird in a hospital ever since the ITT memo was discovered in her desk. Abraham Bolden, the Secret Service agent that went to the Warren Commission, wanted to tell them about the plans to kill Kennedy, was put in a mental institution for 6 years. Another gentleman who has information on the Watergate and the airplane crash in Chicago by the name of Alex Bottis was sent to a mental institution, Springfield, Missouri, this week because he has important evidence that is very shaking to the United States government, to John Mitchell, and to the entire Justice Department. And this is a story that links with all the others, and I'll try to take it and not jump around. I'm going to go slow on this. It's complicated, and it's easy to understand, and it could be one of the biggest stories in the country. It's going to be as big as the ITT, and it involves the Watergate, but it's its own story. At the first of the year last year, we had the Dita Baird memo that was discovered where there was a settlement, there was a court case, an antitrust case involving ITT, and it seems that they offered $400,000 to John Mitchell to settle the case out of court in exchange for favoring the ITT and not breaking up their large holdings. And that thing is not resolved yet, but it's surfacing all the time on the cases of perjury and lies and how the Justice Department favors people that were giving money to the Nixon campaign. Just recently, there was the Vesco scandal. That was the Security Exchange Commission was swindled out of $214 million. And the Vesco Corporation hires Edward Nixon and Donald Nixon, who were important in giving $200,000 to the Nixon campaign in return for getting out of the investigation of their $214 million swindle. John Mitchell made some phone calls and released people from jail. And the money was again given, like all the other espionage money, in a black suitcase in a parking lot, sent to Washington, put in the committee to reelect the president's office, put in the office there, the committee to reelect the president. It wasn't put on the books as a contribution. It ended up as part of the Watergate fund, and the Security Exchange Commission case was called off. Now we have Will Wilson, who was the assistant in the Department of Justice, the criminal division, who was involved in the Texas stock scandal, and he went home. He never was prosecuted. He ran home to Texas and gave up his job as the assistant attorney general in the Justice Department. Now, 4 years ago, the El Paso Gas in Texas had an antitrust suit, and they went before the Justice Department one more time. And John Mitchell put in a word for them, and in exchange for receiving stock from the El Paso Gas, he received a great deal of stock, and the El Paso Gas made $400 million in 4 years. After a four-year period, the Supreme Court reversed the decision on this, but Mitchell still made money in that four-year interim, and just recently the Supreme Court said they had to break that up, that the El Paso Gas couldn't stay. It was an antitrust suit they had to break up. But now it seems that the El Paso Gas money and the profits Mitchell made has been going into funding the Watergate and the Watergate defense team. And a man by the name of Sherman Skolnick, some of you know it, and I can't remember last week, the days go so fast now, whether I mentioned last week that he was kidnapped. He forms a group in Chicago called the Citizens Committee to Clean Up the Courts. And Skolnick this week fled the country and turned over documents of John Mitchell and the Watergate and the United Airlines airplane crash to the Federal Bureau of Investigations. And I'm going to unravel the background of Skolnick and what happened to the Chicago plane crash and how it links to the El Paso Gas and the 100 or more murders that have been related since this thing started to be exposed. This is the mystery story of all times. It is really complicated, and yet it isn't. I talked to Sherman Skolnick this week. As a matter of fact, when he got back, he fled the country and went to Canada, and when he got back, he called me this week because of KLRB having the radio show, and he wanted publicity. He's getting a lot of publicity in the East and in the South, and he wanted me to talk about this case on the radio program, so he airmailed me tapes, documents, and copies of the document that he turned over to the FBI of this very important piece of information that he had to leave the country. The FBI wanted to take it from him, and he fled the country and then turned it over at the border on the way back after a press conference. Skolnick lives in Chicago. He has a 24-hour telephone service. If some night you want to pick up the phone for 90 cents or whatever it costs, the number there, it's 312-375-5741. And Skolnick has this 24-hour telephone recording service discussing graft corruption on the part of the FBI and CIA. His address is 9800 South Oglesby, O-G-L-E-S-B-Y, Chicago, Illinois. I give you Skolnick's name, the Citizens Committee to Clean Up the Courts, because I'll try to remember when the program's over to give it to you, because he'll send you all these documents that I'm going to briefly go over on the air, and maybe you can read them and study them. If you're studying the research seriously now, it's good to have them. He gives seminars on tracing the financing of people believed to agent provocateurs, how to tell provocateurs in the crowd. And Sherman Skolnick has worked very hard exposing judicial corruption in Chicago. He's a paraplegic. He's got a driver who has one arm, and he's a paraplegic. And in his wheelchair, he gets all over town, and he's very courageous. He carried the story for 6 years of Abraham Bolden trying to get people to get him out of the federal penitentiary, the mental hospital, because he was framed for his knowledge of the killing of Kennedy, and he wanted to talk. He exposes false imprisonments and the use of agent provocateurs. And one of the investigators for Sherman Skolnick in Chicago is the name of Alex Botos. He's one of his chief investigators. Now, Skolnick has been working on conflicts of interest and false imprisonments and political espionage for about 10 years. And one of his chief investigators is the name Alex, A-L-L-E-X, Botos, B-O-T-T-O-S. And Alex Botos was working on a government case at the airport in Chicago on December the 8th, 1972. The case he was working on was an airport robbery case. He was working for the government, for the National Strike Force. That's accountable to Nixon, not even to the Justice Department. It's the National Strike Force in Chicago. And he was working with Douglas Roller and Elmer Davidson. And they were investigating a robbery, of an airplane robbery, that involved a gentleman, Sorelli, by the name of Sorelli, who went in the baggage compartment and got certain securities and stocks. But the stocks he got had to do with the El Paso gas and the Watergate, the Mitchell connections. But he had robbed certain... He was wanted on the robbery at the baggage department. And this BOTUS was doing the investigation. At the time, BOTUS was working for the federal government as an investigator. Flight 553 crashed in Chicago. The airplane that carried Mrs. Howard Hunt crashed over Chicago. 553 went down December the 8th, 1972. So as an investigator at the airport, he had access to all the exhibits and documents because his job was to investigate. And they didn't realize what a hot potato this particular airplane crash was. There were four political people on there. There was Michelle Clark, who works for CBS, and she was doing work on the Watergate at the time that the plane, she was going to Chicago because she had important leads for the Watergate assignment. Then there was Mrs. Hunt, who was carrying espionage money for her husband, Howard Hunt. Just this week in the San Jose Mercury and various papers around the country, Jack Anderson had an article about Mrs. Hunt, and he said the funds for the Watergate break-in were distributed by Howard Hunt, who always dealt in cash. And after their arrest, he handed out the cash through his wife, and she delivered the money. Dorothy, who was killed in a Chicago airline crash with $50,000 in her purse, was carrying instructions from Hunt's superiors, and she would meet them at certain places, and they would telephone, and then she would deliver money. It was for defense money, and she was picking up money from various sources and dealing in this cash. Sherman Skolnick said she had $50,000 on her. She didn't have 10, and there was, besides, we talked about the cyanide poisoning. He said there was enough cyanide in the stomachs of these particular people to just kill a whole herd of elephants. The autopsies are being hushed up, too. Well, Mrs. Hunt was on this plane, and she had some very important papers because a lot of the money, evidently, came from the El Paso gas settlement stock that was connected to the El Paso case and to John Mitchell's interest in El Paso, and that Mrs. Hunt had papers and attaché case and things which fell from that airplane that were recovered. And Sherman Skolnick has some of those papers because Bottos got them. See, those are the hot papers that Skolnick had to leave the country with because Bottos had copies of those papers or the originals because they fell at the time of the airplane crash and he was working at the airport as an investigator. Well, also on that plane were two lawyers that we didn't know about. You know, I assume the plane was just to get Mrs. Hunt alone, but there were other political people on that plane. And two of these other lawyers were coming back from Washington that were involved in this in the El Paso gas funding and in the lawsuit that was going to involve and blackmail John Mitchell. Now, the story that Skolnick presented, he mailed me a lawsuit that he has placed in Chicago, and I'm going to take each one of those points about that because it's a $1 million suit. Actually, he raised it to $2 million against an Isabel Burgess who's supposed to be investigating the plane crash that went over Chicago because all the families attended this hearing that Skolnick was at where he presented the lawsuit and the sheriff gave the papers to this woman who's handling the inquiry. Chicago must be really in arms because this story is bound to break soon in the news. It's just being somebody sitting on it right now. But Skolnick has placed a legal complaint in the suit that starting February the 27th, 1973, he went to the Sheraton Motor Hotel at what was called a public hearing to give information about the causes of an airplane crash. This was an aircraft accident hearing, Boeing 737, and he brought information. And that the chairman of the Board of Inquiry wouldn't let him present, when he said what he wanted to present was that the evidence that the plane had been sabotaged, she would not let him present this evidence at the hearing. Skolnick went on to show that many, many deaths had been related to this particular plane crash and is referred to in the lawsuit as a pipeline Watergate matter. That's the El Paso gas, the pipeline Watergate matter. The lawsuit said it was apparent to the plaintiff and his staff, that's Skolnick, that the records, the coroner's office in Lake County, Indiana, was concealing the deaths of over 60 persons that were related to the Watergate airline, the crash, and the pipeline settlement. He says that more than a year ago, the staff began an investigation of the coroner's office at Lake County, Indiana. In the course, they discovered numerous instances where the documents and records were issued at the office purporting to be the signature of the coroner, and they were all altered. In fact, they were not signed by him. It was a fraud. And other death records in Lake County, Indiana, were missing and fraudulent. And it was apparent to the plaintiff and his staff that these records were manufactured to cover up numerous mysterious deaths related to the group that would be called the Pipeline Watergate Matter. Many of them were believed to be murders where persons of witnesses related to the federal criminal indictment. This was the indictment that involved the settlement of that case. Originally, it was to be released in June of 1972, but was delayed. The indictment charged a bribery scheme involving a gas pipeline. See, the bribery scheme was that Mayor Hammond in Indiana was going to expose John Mitchell's links in the Justice Department and settling the case for the El Paso. One gas company lost out in the suit, so they were going to expose John Mitchell in what was called a bribery scheme. Within a few months after the September 8, 72, five East Chicago, Indiana city officials have died. These people are in one way related to the indictment. This is the bribery scheme. And they were going to expose John Mitchell. The city clerk has died. The city controller has died. The city councilman, the chief of the mechanical department, and the chief of the incinerator department have all died. The ambulance driver has been terrified. An attempt has been made to hinder the investigation. A committee investigator and associate of plaintiff, this is Alex Bottos, the one who is just put into a federal mental hospital prison this week, was indicted in a federal court. This particular Bottos was investigating the case, but this week he was sent to a federal penitentiary to get away so he couldn't speak more about the exposure of the documents that were received when the airplane crash went down. Originally, Bottos was investigating the Joseph Cirelli, the crime syndicate gang, and taking securities of $2,100 by entering a baggage compartment. He was the committee investigator for the Justice Department Strike Force. Shortly after the crash of December the 8th of the United Airlines, the Federal Aviation Administration got together and were talking to the committee, the Justice Department Strike Force, about the plane. They believed that the altimeter on the plane was broken and the manipulation of the flight recorders was done for the purpose of murdering at least four people on board. Now, in addition to Mrs. Hunt and Michelle Clark, there were two men employed by the Northern Natural Gas Company that was going to frame John Mitchell in a bribery charge. They were going to reveal his connections to the El Paso gas and the funding of the Watergate. One was Ralph Blodgett, and the other was James Krueger, both employed by the Northern Natural Gas Company of Omaha. And they were meeting in Washington, D.C., and they were warned they would never get to live to Chicago if they brought these matters out, that they wanted to dismissal of the Hammond federal criminal charges against Northern Gas Company. One gas company was getting criminal charges, and the other was getting off easy by giving shares of their stock to the head of the Justice Department, the Attorney General. Among other things, the documents showed or tended to show that another gas pipeline, the El Paso Gas Company, was owned in part by John Mitchell, who got the ownership while he was a U.S. Attorney General and dropped the antitrust charges against El Paso. And Mitchell was deeply involved in the Watergate affair where the gas and oil monies were used. The documents disappeared after Flight 553. persons connected to the previously mentioned Joseph Cirelli airplane robbery gang have access and copies of the documents. You see, Cirelli's group was going to be under indictment and Bonas was investigating them. But in exchange for getting rid evidently of Mrs. Hunt or these two lawyers on the plane, they're dropping the charges against Cirelli and he isn't going to have to go to court. I'm reading the lawsuit now. They threatened to publicly reveal John Mitchell's financial involvement with El Paso Natural Gas Company at a time when Mitchell dropped the suit against them. Shortly after the flight crash 533, Sherman Skolnick was met in a parking lot and offered $100,000 to turn over any documents he had about the Mitchell Watergate Fund, the El Paso Gas, and the committee rejected. The committee is the one for truth and justice in Chicago. It rejected the idea of a settlement. Skolnick wouldn't take $100,000 to hush up. He's a brave guy because it seems the Citizens Committee to clean up the courts. He's in a wheelchair, and it seems to me that with so many murders that he knows about, I think he had a lot of courage to tear them down. They offered him $100,000, but he refused the $100,000, and he said he was going to hold on to the documents and proof that the plane had been sabotaged. Now, he went to the public hearings, which aren't public hearings at all, and all the large corporations were there. They were trying to put a lid on the crash of the United Airlines using a commercial airline where there's so many people involved, and this crash was supposed to be examined publicly. People had claims would speak up or any evidence of the truth. But when Sherman Skolnick went there and wanted to speak up and had documents of motives for the plane not coming down or the reasons it's not coming down and proof that the plane was tampered with, they wouldn't let him speak. So this is why he's pressing the lawsuit. And in the lawsuit, he says the Board of Inquiry is dominated by large corporate interests who appear to be against any disclosure such as possible sabotage. Unless they are originated by them, they won't expose anything. Burgess, in the so-called public hearings, dominates the line of inquiry and large interest. Pratt and Whitney are the airplane engine manufacturer. Boeing is the airplane manufacturer, and the United Airlines will not allow any evidence of espionage to come into the public hearings. Now, that's interesting because the Appointment Secretary of Richard Nixon, Dwight Chapin, has been named as part of the espionage team at the Watergate. And when he left the White House, he was sent to Chicago to United Airlines for employment. Now, that's at a time when all these hearings are going on. So if the White House had anything to do with sabotaging the airplanes, they have Dwight Chapin out there at every hearing and keeping track and recording back to John Mitchell who was saying what and what's happening. And he's part of the United Airlines team now, from the White House to United, and it is being said by Sherman Skolnick that this group was involved in bringing the airplane down. The defendant, Isabel Burgess, has been charged with $1 million, and then there was another million put on for not being allowed to get in front of the Board of Inquiry the truth of what happened to that airplane. Now, Sherman Skolnick was told to meet somebody behind a parking lot. He gets a lot of information in that way. People provide stories for him. They don't want to meet in an office or on a telephone. And the minute he went to a particular parking lot, he realized that he was with FBI men. He said they didn't have to tell me, and they had walkie-talkies. And they asked him, where are those documents? You have the proof of what you're saying about the funding of the Watergate thing, the El Paso gas, and the reasons for bringing that plane down. And he had these documents with him, and he didn't have them with him. He said he'd go home and get them. So they said, okay, go home. So he and his aide spent 3 days just getting from Chicago, Illinois, up to Detroit, and they took every back road, and they left a message if they didn't call in the office by 9 o'clock, the police should be called. They didn't get up to Detroit, and it took 3 days, and they went down dirt roads in every which way so they wouldn't be traced. And then he went into Canada and held a press conference. And after the press conference, he came back into this country, and they say, do you have anything to declare? Do you have anything at the border? And so he asked for the most important person that he knew at the at the border who handles these very sensitive matters, and that person came out and he took his name at the customs office, and the man was really upset, Frederick Lawrence, because he was photographed. Skolnick's aide carries a camera and photographs him. And he said, "Is he a newsman?" And he said, "No, I want you to be photographed because you're holding all the film with copies of proof of the Watergate pipeline documents." And the poor guy is standing there. So he said, "I want these handed to the FBI." So the FBI was at the border of Canada and Michigan, and he was photographed receiving the Watergate pipeline documents. So nobody can say that the Justice Department doesn't have them. Now, then Skolnick, who has his own printing office, printed out 70,000 stories about this particular episode and went on the streets of Chicago handing them out and having press conferences. So the White House is really uptight, and the FBI and CIA in Chicago are really uptight, he says. And I still think it took a lot of courage for him to speak up and try to expose these documents. Well, he turned what he had over. He sent one copy out of the country to Europe. It was photographed. And then one copy he turned over to the federal government. So they can't say they don't have it. They may say they lost it or they destroyed it, but they can't say they don't have it. And the important thing is using the Justice Department to settle cases out of court that favor a particular group, taking stock yourself when you are making the decisions on whether the case will be settled, making tremendous profits and money, then using some of that money to fund espionage operations, then using people being blackmailed because the El Paso thing and blowing up those men, and because those men are blackmailed, the Sorelli case isn't going to go through. Mr. Bottos is locked up in jail, so the main witness to the Sorelli case gets off, and they'll probably never have a hearing. There was a brochure that Skolnick had printed out on how the federal marshals took Bottas away. He was at a building and they dragged him off and took him away with chains around his feet and his hands and like a real criminal. And he's off in Springfield, Missouri at the prison that's used for political prisoners. How long he's going to stay there, you know, nobody knows. But a man like Skolnick's trying to get attention to the situation, and I'm sure that Jack Anderson and others are going to pick it up soon because it's really, as I say, in Indiana alone, there were 60 deaths that Skolnick attributed to this particular Watergate pipeline case that people were in on that have been murdered. Well, we have about 7-8 minutes to cover a whole week of Watergate resume. The news is breaking so fast. Evel Younger said this week that Watergate could hurt him. I'm glad he admitted it, and I hope it does, because Evel Younger has been at the head of the Justice Department in California. If he didn't help plan criminal conspiracies, he helped conceal them. And that's not what the Justice Department is supposed to do. Those agencies are designed to protect us, not to kill us. And the Watergate thing is affecting Evel Younger. When he says it's affecting him, you can believe it is, because usually the top officials always have this great deniability, like nothing touches their skin. Well, when Lewis Tagwood's book comes out about agent provocateurs and the chain of command of conspiracies, Evel Young will be in there. But Mr. Younger is getting very clean now. There was a group that were mentioned when he ran for office previously, the Evel Younger Club. It's a slush fund like Richard Nixon, and it's money that pours in to expose him to go all around and do what he wants. Well, today Evel Younger said he would never again use the EJY Club as raising money. He says it was a fundraising device that he employed in the 1970 race. He got a lot of money from people, again, that were related to the Defense Department, the intelligence agencies, and he had this little slush fund going for him, and he doesn't want that to be investigated, because if he has that open fund that you give to him, then the decisions he makes or the things he does look like they're in behalf of those people. So Mr. Kling, Evel Younger, is not going to have his little slush fund, at least not in the open anymore. And he says the Watergate hurts him. Somebody else who's hurting is Richard Nixon. The CIA attorney, Mr. Altsch, came out this week. He resented the fact that Bernard Fensterwald from the Committee to Investigate Assassinations became James Ray's lawyer. Mr. Ash was out doing business in Chicago, and he had to leave his client. I imagine the Chicago thing has to do with the the pipeline Watergate exposure this week, because he left McCord, which is his assignment, to go to Chicago. So you get a picture of some of the priority happening there. But he didn't like the idea of Fensterwald from the Committee to Investigate Assassinations to be representing McCord. McCord wants to tell the truth about what happened and why he was hired. And so Ash had a press conference and said what he thought McCord was doing was that he just wanted to see the White House scream. Well, maybe the White House will scream. There's a lot of people screaming. You know, napalm makes you scream, too. There's a lot of people hurting, you know, that have been victims of these particular gentlemen for a long time. So if the White House is screaming now, just wait another week or month. And I don't really want blood. It's just that it's very exciting that the whole method of clandestine government, of overthrowing, of sabotage, is being exposed. The average American can't even absorb it because he can't even admit there was one conspiracy yet. But yet the news is breaking every day, and the editorials and the conservative Republicans are yelling. And the division of the police state and the conspirator and the conservative Republic is becoming more clear. And the Republicans are resenting the way that the Republican Party was used, and that they're just as willing or more willing than the Democrats. I don't hear the Democrats yelling half as hard as the Republicans this week. One of the things that was in the news this last Saturday was the Senate probe now has information that top White House people with a history of being involved in similar activities in past elections were involved again in 72, espionage and bugging activities. We're talking about people around Nixon from 1962. That was an allegation made this week. I know that the truth of the whole chain of political assassinations will go from the Bay of Pigs up to the Watergate, and it's breaking at a lot of different levels. But the Senate has information now that it goes back to 62. I think that I try to tell students that I meet, you know, that if they just, or anyone else who saves articles, cut out all your Watergate articles for the next year. You really will find them interesting a year from now, because there's a big tide changing. A lot of truths are coming out. Not because the Congress wants them to, not because the Justice Department wants them to, not even because Judge Sirica wants them to. See, he didn't have to accept a guilty plea by the man and close the case. Only because James McCord wants to tell the truth. Now, that's the important thing. Then behind him are a team of researchers, and Fletcher Prouty, formerly of the CIA, and Bud Fensterwald, and the Committee to Investigate Assassinations. Now, there's a lot of people, and if the truth is coming out, it's because McCord wants to tell. If there weren't James McCord, you may not know the truth. There was an interesting article about McCord, the mystery figure, in the New York Times this week. Yeah, once on a program about 5 weeks ago, I was reading the double role of Howard Hunt, the aliases, the wives, the children, and he had an interesting background that was really mysterious. Well, the New York Times had an article about McCord this week that he gave it, when he was in the FBI, he gave his birth date and also when he was arrested as being October the 9th, 1918. Then when he signed out for bail, he gave the date of July 26, 1924. When people began to say, who is James McCord? He said he and his wife both graduated from Baylor College. Now it turns out that Baylor College never has any record of their attendance. The government put him down when he was arrested as being a lesser figure in the entire CIA operation. But Fletcher Prouty, who worked for the CIA and said that he was introduced to McCord by Alan Dulles as the number one man. And Alan Dulles said, he's the number one man, and he is my top man. And they used him to do the U-2 flights over Russia. He spoke Russian, and they used him for top intelligence work. McCord worked in the FBI from 42 to 46. Now, there's missing years again. 46 to 48 is missing. There's absolutely no record of what he did. He went back from 48 to 51, and then he was with the Bay of Pigs in 1961, and McCord worked with this same team at that time. One of the interesting things about McCord was when he left the CIA, he taught at Montgomery College, close to his home, two semesters. And the name of the course was Industrial and Retail Security Work. And it was described in the school catalog as the Historical, Philosophical, and Legal Basis of Government and Industrial Security Program in a Democratic Society. One of the students of the class told how McCord assigned the students to one of them to do a project to bug the Democratic headquarters in Washington, D.C. as a student. That's the professor. Well, the catalog says that he was teaching security in a democratic society. The words are all turned around. It's hard to understand what's going on today because everything is justice is injustice, and a democratic society is one that you overthrow. There was a man mentioned a lot during the elections by the name of Richard Tuck. Oh, time is up here. I'm wandering away. Hey, are you ready in there? We've got to close. I've got about 50 articles on the Watergate here, and I threw them in an envelope, the most important of the week, and I thought we'd talk about, but there's no more time. So we'll go on next week, okay? See you next week.